This boy, apparently, didn't know what a terrible menace Corin was.
Big man, red hair, and a lady with straight dark hair. Yeah, they came by yesterday, then back this way again. What's it to you?
When do they come back? Out of town? Corin asked excitedly.
Roddy squinted warily.
An hour or so before dark.
Why?
But I didn't see them on the road, Corin sputtered.
Roddy shrugged.
There's a fork in the road, half a mile up that away. Maybe they went the other way last night.
But they wouldn't. They wouldn't leave me.
Corin's head spun. He leaned against a fence post. Roddy's eyes opened wide. When he caused more than the usual amount of trouble around the village, his parents sometimes threatened to toss him out of the house. Until he met Corin, it never occurred to Roddy that some parents actually did abandon their children.
Your ma and pa, they just up and leave you here?
I don't.
Corin had trouble breathing.
I don't know. They couldn't. They wouldn't do that. Not my parents.
Maybe,
Roddy said fearfully, with a guilty glance at the stolen pie.
You caused them a lot of trouble or something?
No,
Corin grumbled, his head spinning.
Maybe, yes.
Huh.
Suddenly, Roddy didn't feel like eating the other half of the pie. He shouldn't have stolen it from the innkeeper.
Hey, do you want the rest of this pie?
Giving the pie to a hungry person would, in Roddy's mind, make up for having stolen it in the first place. Roddy held the pie out, and Corin took it without looking at it.
Why would they leave me here?
You got folks round Tinsdale? That's our town.
No, we're from...
Corin decided not to tell Roddy where he was from, lest the boy figure out who Corin was and tell his parents.
Hey, listen, maybe your folks...
Roddy paused as a man's voice drifted across the field.
Uh-oh, that's my pa. I'm supposed to be doing chores. You, hey, good luck to you. Don't tell nobody who gave you the pie.
Roddy hopped down off the stump and ran across the field, determined now to do his chores the way his pa wanted. Corin looked at the pie in his hands, looked at the lonely road stretched out in front of him, and began walking, eating the pie as he went along, without enjoying or even tasting it. When he arrived at the fork in the road, he saw the previous night's rain had washed away any trace of wagon tracks. Feeling completely miserable, Corin sat with his back to the signpost and used a handful of grass to wipe the pie plate clean. His parents would not have abandoned him, even if he had caused them so much trouble that they had been chased out of their home. There must be some kind of mistake. Yes, that was it. A mistake. A misunderstanding. Why, even now, his parents were probably searching the wood where he was supposed to be waiting. With hope renewed, Corin propped the pie plate up against the signpost and hurried back down the road, headed for the clearing where he had spent the wet, lonely night. He had to run no more than a quarter of a mile when he saw a tall merchant's carriage, accompanied by three armed guards on horseback.
"Clear the road, boy!"
the driver shouted, and Corin stumbled off the side of the road. Corin took off his hat.
"Please, sir, have you seen a wagon with a man and a woman on this road?"
"No," replied the rider. "Not a soul since the morning, not on this road."
One of the guards pulled his horse to a stop next to Corin.
"You looking for someone, boy?"
the guard asked in a low voice. Corin noticed the guard had his hand on his sword and was looking warily into the woods, even as he spoke.
"Yes, sir. My parents, sir."
"Guard, leave that stupid boy to himself and get back to your post,"
the merchant shouted as he leaned out the window of the closed carriage.
"I don't pay you to talk to strange brats on the road."
The guard looked at Corin, shrugged, and tossed him a pair of copper coins.
Sorry. Good luck to you, boy.
The guard spurred his horse onward to catch up with the carriage, and then Corin was alone again. He sat down on the side of the road, staring at the two copper coins. The coins were silent. They could not explain what had happened, or tell him what to do. It was growing dark by the time Corin picked himself up off the road. His parents had indeed abandoned him, just as Roddy said. He was too much trouble to bother with. The last straw for his parents must have been when they discovered that even people in the distant village of Tinsdale knew about their son, about Corin the Jinx, and wanted to keep him away. As long as Corin was with them, his parents could not have any sort of decent life anywhere in the whole province, perhaps even the kingdom, they must have realized. And so, on their way out of Tinsdale, they had turned the wagon south instead of coming back for their trouble-causing son. It was all his fault, Corin knew. If only he could find his parents again, he would promise not to cause any trouble ever again. If only he could find them. But how? He didn't know where his mother's relative lived, and he needed to stay out of towns anyway. He needed to go back to the fork in the road, take the turn his parents had made, and hope to catch up to them. If he walked steadily, without taking time to sleep, he could catch up to his parents, he knew he could. Corin brushed some of the dirt off his pants, wiped a tear out of his eye, and set off on the way he had come. Never looking back. The decision to follow the fork in the road, instead of going back to the clearing in the woods where his parents had told him to wait, made all the difference in the rest of Corin's life. If he had continued down the road another mile, he might have noticed ruts gouged into the embankment where someone had pushed a wagon off the road. He may have followed the faint tracks, mostly washed away by the rain, and found the wagon in the woods, covered under a pile of brush. He may have seen bandits' arrows stuck in the side of the wagon. He may have noticed angry red traces of blood on the side of the wagon. The wagon, which now lay empty, stripped of everything valuable. Corin never saw the tracks, never saw the wagon. He reached the fork in the road as night fell, screwed up his courage, and walked forward in the darkness, hopelessly hoping to catch up to the wagon. Chapter 2 13 and nearly a quarter year-old Arianna Trehame rummaged through the wardrobe cabinet, pushing aside jackets, skirts, robes, and selected a white dress. She bit her lip as she studied the dress, then put it back. It was nice, but too simple. Three other white dresses also failed her inspection, all either too plain or too fancy, until she found a dress with half-length sleeves, just enough lace, and beads that sparkled like tiny diamonds. Arianna held the dress up in front of her and faced the mirror. She thought the sparkling beads nicely set off her rather pale green eyes. The curls of her auburn hair fell around her shoulders and over her eyes. She tossed her head to get the hair out of the way. "Now what are you doing here, young lady?" asked an older woman as she swept into Arianna's bedchambers, which was a suite of rooms which took up one whole wing of Duke Yaron's castle. Although the Duke's wife, who usually occupied these bedchambers, probably thought the rooms were opulent, the cold grey stone and white plaster walls of the old castle were rather dreary compared to the Trehames' royal palace in Linden, where Crown Princess Arianna lived. The woman was a maid named Norelka, and she had an armful of clothes weighing her down. Older to young Arianna meant that Norelka was the ripe old age of 37, which clearly was impossibly, unimaginably ancient. Norelka's own children were now grown and living on their own, but the woman had been a nanny, and now a maid, to Arianna since she was a baby. Norelka had short black hair, a kind of roundish face, and a perpetually worried expression when she was around Arianna. "Trying on gowns," Arianna said with a slight frown as she twirled in front of the mirror, making her cascading curls of hair swing around. "The Duchess brought a whole trunkful of clothes in for me yesterday. Mother wants me to dress up for this stupid dinner tonight. I'm going to be queen and command an army. I should be talking maps and defense strategy with Yaren's captains, not attending boring dinners." "Your mother thinks this dinner is important. Why do you want to look at maps and talk about war anyway? Your mother doesn't do that." "My mother wasn't raised to be queen. Her parents never expected her to do anything but marry a rich man. No one ever thought she would be regent." The Lady Carlana Trehame was a loving mother and, in the opinion of her daughter, the Crown Princess, a frustrating disappointment as regent. Until Arianna became queen on her 16th birthday, her mother would exercise power in Arianna's name as the Regent of Terador. Although exercising mostly meant her mother timidly did nothing, while Terador's allies became fearful, and the power of her enemy grew. "Someone needs to think about defending Terador since my mother is too afraid to do anything about it." Norelka knew Arianna disapproved of the way her mother was handling her regency, so she changed the subject. "That dress is beautiful," Norelka said, setting her clothes down over the back of a chair. Arianna stood in front of the mirror, smoothing the gown so it lay properly against her. "This would be a beautiful wedding gown."
"And why are you thinking about wedding dresses?"
Norelka shook her head in mock amazement.
"Is there a young man you have in mind? Perhaps Mark Yaren?"
"Oh, he's so dull."
Arianna hung the dress back up, no longer in the mood for playing dress-up. The purpose of Arianna getting out of the palace to visit Duke Yaren and his family in the home of Levan province was for her to get to know the dukes and duchesses who would be her vassals when she became Queen of Terador. Since the snow had melted off the roads in the springtime of the year, she had visited Duke Romero in Winterthur, Duchess Portis in Anschluss, Duke Magnico in Relanon, and now Duke Yaren in Levan. All were allies, or at least not active rivals, of the ruling Trehame family. All were unfailingly polite and gracious hosts. All had seen to the Crown Princess's every need and desire, and all had tried to subtly point out how smart, how handsome, how strong, and how responsible their eligible sons were. Whether those sons were aged 22 or 10, as long as they weren't already married, could walk without tripping over their own feet, and could manage not to be completely tongue-tied around the lovely young Crown Princess, none of their parents had missed an opportunity to push their sons at Arianna in case she showed any interest. She hadn't. Not yet. Some of the boys were cute enough. Now, after being constantly on the road and away from the palace that was her home, all she wanted to do was go home.
"Does my mother really expect me to choose a husband now? I'm not even 14. I haven't even kissed a boy yet."
Norelka looked away, out the window, so the young princess wouldn't see her suppress a laugh.
"You had better not choose a husband now. Your mother expects you to show interest in all of these boys, to string them and their parents along, give them hope, and keep them guessing. Until you're 16 and you get your crown, you and your mother are at the mercy of the Regency Council."
the dukes and duchesses who ruled the seven provinces of Tarador.
And your mother needs leverage over that pack of scheming jackals until you're safely on the throne.
They're not all jackals, Arianna sniffed. The Arryns have been allies to the Trahaemes for centuries.
And the Manyikos you can also count on, in a pinch.
The Manyikos had inherited Relanon province from the Trahaemes when the Trahaemes had taken over the throne of Tarador.
That's two out of seven provinces. The others are either against you or would go against you if it bettered their own positions.
Your mother needs to worry about this now, and you need to pay attention if you want that throne waiting for you in a couple of years.
When Arianna's father, Adric Trahaeme, had been killed in battle 8 years ago, he had only one child, 5-year-old Arianna. Her mother, Carlana, had been chosen to serve as regent and rule Tarador in Arianna's name until Arianna was old enough to become queen. Adric's brother had more interest in drinking wine and racing horses than ruling Tarador, and the seven dukes and duchesses of the Regency Council had all wanted power for themselves. No duke or duchess wanted to support a rival for power, so Carlana had been a compromise to serve as regent, a compromise agreed to because the dukes and duchesses thought Carlana was weak and easily controlled. Since the day she was elected regent, Carlana had one goal, to ensure her daughter assumed the throne on her 16th birthday. To do that, Carlana and her daughter needed to strengthen bonds with their allies and keep their rivals off balance.
Arianna sighed. She knew all this. Her mother reminded her about it almost every day.
Nori, Arianna said, reverting to the name she had called her maid as a little girl. Today, all I want to do is ride down the river and have a picnic. It's the one thing I've wanted to do since we got here, even if I have to go with Yaren's brats.
Then let's get you dressed properly. You can't go out in the woods in your nightgown.
Relka pointed to the clothing that lay over the back of the chair.
Arianna hugged her arms tightly around herself.
It's chilly out there. Why can't I wear pants like the boys all do? I saw some girls wearing pants yesterday.
Those were peasant girls, were harvesting potatoes in the fields, and only some of the youngest of them were wearing pants. You don't work on a farm. You're a princess, and princesses don't wear pants.
When I'm queen, I'm going to declare that all women can wear pants if they want to,
Arianna said stubbornly, and picked out a woolen dress to wear.
When you are queen, you can wear soldier's armor and a fruit basket on your head, and everyone will think you've gone mad.
Arianna laughed at the thought of such an absurd outfit.
This dress will be warm enough, and good for riding.
Arianna had wanted to ride a boat down the river, where they could meet her guards, have a picnic lunch, and ride horses back. It was a beautiful autumn morning, chilly, but promising to become sunny and warm.
Soon enough, she would be back at the palace, stuck inside for the winter. One nice thing about being a princess was being able to order her guards around. It almost made up for having to wear dresses.
Corin woke when a large drop of dew fell from the tip of a leaf right onto his nose. He yawned and stretched and rose wearily to his feet, stretching his cold and stiff muscles. It was chilly that morning, and the trees were tinged bright red and orange as the leaves began to turn color. Summer was certainly over. A mist covered the ground in the forest, gathering thick in the low pockets of land. And the forest, in summertime filled with a chorus of insects buzzing, birds singing, and little frogs peeping to each other in spring-fed ponds, was silent. Too silent. He sat still, listening intently,
for he knew birds stopped singing sometimes if danger were near. Quietly, slowly, he climbed the two lower branches of the tree he'd been sleeping under and looked around. These weren't his woods he'd been camping in. These weren't anyone's woods, that he could tell. He had explored for miles and found nothing but old campsites. The forest was a true wilderness. He pulled his only jacket tightly around him, shivering, blowing on his hands to warm his stiff fingers, before he made his way back to the ground. Today, he needed to find straw or dried moss to stuff inside his jacket, and pants to keep him warm, before winter arrived. Using dry leaves that he'd kept inside his jacket overnight, Corin started a fire, blowing gently on the flickering flames to make it burn hot and clean, carefully adding twigs and then small sticks. Smoke and steam would drift through and above the woods and let anyone around know where Corin was, and he didn't want anyone finding him. Especially, he didn't want anyone sneaking up on him. For not all the dangers in the wilderness walked on four legs. As he warmed his fingers, Corin looked around the woods, at the sheltered spot where he'd been camping. With summer gone and winter approaching, he needed to think about building a real shelter where he could survive the cold. These woods had plenty of game. The river had plenty of fish, and Corin hadn't seen any people around. No. Not this place, he decided. He would keep walking south for another couple weeks. South meant warmer temperatures, if his mother was right about that sort of thing. She was from somewhere in the south of Tarador. Yes. South for 2 or 3 weeks. Then he needed to find or build a shelter. He had been out in winter cold overnight before, while hunting with his father. But they'd always been able to wait for good weather, and the warmth of home had never been no more than a day or two away. But this winter, he would be at the mercy of the weather, with only his wits to keep him alive until springtime. Where would he go? It didn't matter, as long as it was toward the south. He didn't have any particular place to go. He'd given up on trying to find his parents. That first night that he'd travelled alone, he came to a crossroads, where the roads went in four directions. Wagon tracks led every which way, leaving no clue as to where his parents had gone. Not more than 2 miles further south was another crossroads, where three roads went south, across three bridges over the river. His parents had been clever, Corin had to admit. They had abandoned him at the best possible location, so that he had no chance of following them. And his parents had left him his pack, which had knives, fishing hooks, and other supplies that should be enough for any farm boy to survive in the wilderness. Corin had gone from being shocked, to sad, to angry, to grudging acceptance at his fate. His parents were gone. They had given him a chance to survive on his own. Now his future was up to him, and only him. As his father had said, however bad Corin's lot in life, someone out there had it worse. Not knowing where else to go from the first crossroads, he'd walked steadily in a general southerly direction, trying to stay ahead of the changing seasons, keeping away from towns and out of sight as much as possible. Once, when he was very hungry, he had snuck onto a farm and stolen a handful of eggs, but as he sat down to eat them, he considered the children who likely lived on the farm. The missing eggs would not go unnoticed, and the children would get into trouble with their parents. Corin lost his appetite, thinking that he might cause some other boy or girl to be abandoned by their parents. So he returned to the farm before daylight and put the eggs back. Since then, he had lived on plants he had found in the forest, and fishing and trapping provided just enough food.
His pack contained his meager supply of possessions, two knives, fish hooks and twine, flint for starting fires, a length of rope, a small tarp, a thin sweater and a jacket. Corin was not terribly worried about being able to survive in the forest, except for during the winter. No child grew up on a farm in Winterthur province, boy or girl, without knowing how to hunt and fish, how to make clothing out of deer hide, to make a bow and arrows, how to find plants and roots to eat. For this morning, he had a few wild potatoes and carrots that he'd found the day before. With a fire started, he huddled next to it for warmth while he roasted the vegetables for breakfast. When the carrots and potatoes were roasted soft, he munched on them, watching the small fire burn down. Corin stood up abruptly, kicking dirt into the fire to put it out without any smoke. Fires reminded him of home. A fire glowing on the hearth in their cozy kitchen, warming the house on a cold day, with a pot of stew hung over the flames, and his mother stirring and sprinkling in seasonings. Fires reminded him of home. And he now didn't have a home or a family. So he didn't want to be reminded. When the fire was safely out, he ate a roasted potato while he made his way through the forest. It was time to check on the trap he'd placed in the river, to see if any fish had been caught during the night. He hopped on rocks, out into the river, to where he had set the trap. It was in a good place, for just downstream the river picked up speed as it fell through a series of rapids. The strong current should push fish into his trap. Success! He would eat well that day, he thought hungrily. There were three fat fish swimming in the trap. Corin quickly lowered the upstream gate so the fish could not get out. With one of his knives, he sharpened the end of a stick and held it like a spear, waiting for a fish to swim close. Voices startled him, and he crouched down behind a rock. Sound traveled far across water. He heard deep voices, more than one man, and a higher sound. A girl? What were they doing here in the wilderness? Corin had not seen a single person for 3 weeks, and he had been camping in these very woods for 8 days. He tucked his knife into his belt, used the spear for a balance, and leaped across rocks back to the shore, to hide behind bushes on the riverbank. A small boat floated into view. Such a boat Corin had never seen before. It was no more than 20 feet long, narrow, brightly painted, with the carved head of a dragon on the front. A man paddled at the front, and two more men used paddles at the rear. In between were two boys and a girl, roughly his age. The men were armed with bows and short swords, and the children were wearing brightly colored clothes, the likes of which Corin had never seen. Even the Baron of Crichton County could scarcely afford such fine clothing. Where was the boat going? Surely the man in the bow could see the rapids ahead. He did. The man called out, and the boat turned, steering for a gravel bank just upstream from Corin. Corin had a moment of panic. His pack was hanging from a tree near where the boat was headed. Everything Corin owned was in that pack. He needed to crawl back through the bushes over to... Corin never finished that thought. The strange boat was almost ashore. The man in the front had laid down his paddle and swung a leg over the side to get it out, when there was a blood-freezing roar, and the largest bear Corin had ever seen burst out of the woods and crashed into the boat. Before anyone could react, the boat flipped over, spilling everyone out. The two men in the back were trapped underneath. The two boys were flung onto the gravel bank. The girl was tossed out to land with a splash in the river, and the man in front was knocked to fall face first into the water. The bear stepped back, momentarily confused, then focused on the girl, and bounded over the upturned boat.
The man who had been in front of the boat rolled to his feet and tried to draw his sword, but the bear swatted him with his great paw, and the man was flung onto the shore, his sword flying away into the river. Corin expected the girl to scream as the bear reared up in front of her. Instead, she reached down to the river bottom, picked up a smooth stone, and threw it to hit the bear square on the nose. The bear stopped in its tracks and covered its now bloody nose with a paw. The girl lost her balance and stumbled backward to hit her head on a rock. She slumped on her back, her face barely above the water. The bear shook its head, dropped its paw away from its nose, and rose up on its back paws to stand over the girl, its front claws glinting like daggers in the sunlight. Corin's feet were splashing into the river before he knew what he was doing. He shouted something at the bear, holding one hand, palm outwards, towards the great beast, his other hand reaching for the girl. To his great surprise, the bear was pushed violently backwards. It rolled to sit on its haunches in the river, swinging its front paws around like its face were being attacked by a swarm of bees. The bear roared again, splashed back to the shore, crashed headfirst into a tree, as if it were blinded, and disappeared into the forest, bellowing as it went along. Corin was so surprised to still be alive that he fell right on his butt into the chilly river up to his waist. The two guards who had been under the boat were now standing near the boat, looking dazed, but holding their swords with grim determination. Corin turned to look for the girl. She had lost her grip on the rock and was drifting helplessly into the current, her head barely above the water, one arm waving weakly. As she drifted by, she and Corin locked eyes for a split second. They were the most beautiful eyes Corin had ever seen, ever imagined, a striking pale green that drew him in. How a moment could last a lifetime, Corin didn't know. But in that moment, time stood still, and he was lost. "Help me," her eyes pleaded.
"Oi, you boy, get away,"
one of the men warned, as he splashed unsteadily into the river. Corin knew the man would not reach the girl in time. She was already being spun around as the river gathered force to rush through the rapids. Corin hauled himself to his feet and saw that his only chance to catch the girl was to leap from one rock to the next until she was right at the first rapid. He might be able to jump in and hang on to the girl as she was swept by. He jumped wildly from rock to rock, his feet skidding and slipping, bruising his knees and knuckles as he steadied himself from falling. Just as he reached the last rock, he saw the girl plunged under the water. Corin took a deep breath as he launched himself into the air. Somehow, Corin found the girl under the water and held onto her. Held onto the girl, thinking of nothing else but clutching her to him as they were carried along, plunging down one rapid after another. When he could, he held the girl's face up so she could breathe. Even so, they both swallowed water and choked as he struggled to stay afloat. His body was battered as he was bashed against rocks by the tremendous, unrelenting force of the water. Atop one swell of water, just before they plunged down over a fall, Corin saw a relatively still pool to the right and willed the water to sweep him in that direction. As they fell, he kicked his feet with all his might before the swirling water spun him upside down, and he swallowed a mouthful of water. Corin gagged and almost lost his grip on the girl as he spat out the water. He needed air. Desperately, he twisted to lift his head out of the water and found they were floating in a pool, a backwater where the current lazily spun around. The girl coughed, spitting out water. Corin swung his legs down and found he could stand on a rock. With the last of his strength, he waded onto a wide, flat rock near the riverbank and pulled the girl to flop down next to him.
A girl rolled onto her side, coughing and choking out water.
Help!
Corin managed to cry between breaths. When he could move again, he reached out for the girl. She was dazed, her eyes open, but unfocused. Her dress was torn, her arms and legs covered with bruises. Corin tried to stand and found his own limbs so battered and cold that he could barely control his hands and feet. Blood seeped from cuts and scrapes all over him, his already rough pants and shirt now ripped in so many places he could never patch them together again. Corin was startled by the faint scratching sounds of something, or someone, trying to move quietly through the woods along the riverbank. And there was another, louder sound, further away, but drawing closer. Men's voices, shouting, and what Corin thought were horses making their way through the woods at high speed. The bushes along the shore above his head parted, and a man stepped out, followed by three more men. They were the type of men his parents warned against. Hard-looking, carrying swords and knives, wicked grins on their faces.
What have we here? A rich girl, looks like. And her servant. I bet her parents would pay a pretty price to have their daughter back, in one piece. Huh, boys?
Bandits. It was Corin's bad luck to stumble across woods that bandits were using as a hideout. Truly his life was jinxed. Corin rose unsteadily to his feet and pulled a knife from his belt.
Stay away from her,
he said in a voice hoarse from choking on water. He had never fought with a knife before, but it was a good blade, dwarf-made, and everyone knew dwarves were the finest metalworkers in the land.
What? The lady's pet has a sting. Forget her, boy. Drop that knife and we'll give you a share of the ransom money. More than you'd earn in a lifetime, I think.
Hurry up about it, Togan. We've got company coming,
one of the other bandits said, as the sound of men and horses crashing through the woods grew louder. The man called Togan eased down the steep bank to stand on the rock in front of Corin.
I'll not say it again, boy. Stand aside. There's no need for...
Togan struck, moving his knife in a slashing motion toward Corin's face, expecting the boy would flinch and back away. Instead, Corin's own hand came up faster than he could see, and his knife cut Togan's wrist, forcing the bandit to drop the knife.
Argh!
Togan held his bloody wrist with his other hand. Corin found his ears burning red at the bad words Togan was screaming in front of a girl.
Don't curse in front of a lady, mister,
Corin scolded the man.
What?
The other bandits stared open-mouthed at Corin as if they'd just discovered he had two heads. Who was this idiot boy? What kind of person cared about being polite when attacked by bandits?
Kill him.
Togan growled as he tried to scramble backwards up the riverbank. One of the other bandits grasped Togan's shirt collar and pulled to help the wounded man up, but Togan slipped and fell heavily onto the rock.
Help me up,
Togan ordered, as the sounds of men and horses crashing their way through the underbrush was now very loud, and Corin could see bushes swaying along the riverbank as the horses knocked them aside in their haste.
Too late. Good luck to you, Togan,
said the bandit, who had been trying to help Togan, and at that, the other bandits melted back into the woods.
Ungrateful scum! I'll get you for this!
Togan shouted after his disloyal fellow criminals.
And you!
The bandit picked up his knife with his one good hand.
Forget that girl! I'm gonna kill you!
I don't think so,
Corin said, keeping himself between Togan and the girl, his knife ready. For some reason he couldn't explain, with a knife in his hand, he wasn't afraid, not one bit. Men on horseback burst out of the woods, and a half-dozen men slid off their saddles, drawing swords or fitting arrows to bowstrings. Corin was about to say he was glad to see the men, when their leader, A tall man wearing a tunic emblazoned with a golden dragon shouted at his men.
Bandits! Seize them both! Kill them if they move!
Corin's heart fell. There he was, standing over the girl, a knife in his hand, just like Togan the bandit. Of course the soldiers thought he, too, was a bandit. If he were captured, Togan would likely confirm that Corin was indeed a bandit, and Corin would be thrown into a dungeon or hanged. Corin glanced behind him at the river. He would rather take his chances in the rapids than be captured by these men. The leader of the soldiers saw Corin looking at the river and knew what he was thinking.
Don't you move, boy. I'll shoot you if I must.
The man scrambled down the riverbank. Just then, the girl moaned and raised a hand to her face. It was enough of a distraction for Corin to spin around, leap onto a rock, and throw himself into the river. He almost made it, but the soldiers were experienced and disciplined, and one of the men put an arrow into Corin's left shoulder. Shocked by the searing pain, Corin dropped his knife and fell head first into the foaming rapids.
Find him,
the leader ordered, and two of his men climbed out on rocks into the river. But Corin could not be seen. The wounded boy had been swept under, likely to drown, if the arrow hadn't killed him. Corin was barely aware of something gently rocking him side to side. There was a bright light above him. He blinked, and it hurt to look at the light. He hurt all over, especially his head and his left shoulder. The rocking motion was making his shoulder hurt even more. Pain, which made him grit his teeth and tears to run down his face. The shock was giving him chills, chills not caused just by the cold river water. To protect his left shoulder, he rolled to his right and almost breathed in a mouthful of water. He was laying on his back, in shallow water near a riverbank, below the last of the rapids. The current was rocking him side to side. Somehow, he had survived the trip through the raging waters. How far he had been pulled down the river, he did not know. The bright light above him was the noonday sun. This part of the river was wide and calm, with only a few ripples on the surface to show how fast the current was moving. It was quiet and peaceful, except for horses. Again, the sound of men and horses. They were hunting him. They would never stop hunting him. The soldiers would never believe Corin had only wanted to help the girl. After all, they had seen with their own eyes that he was a bandit, hadn't they? He rolled onto his knees in the shallow water and used his right arm to push himself to his feet. He could barely stand. The pain in his left shoulder was making him sick to his stomach. He felt with his right hand and discovered part of the arrow shaft still stuck out from his shoulder. He needed to get it out somehow. Later. Horses splashed into the water on the other side of the river, and men shouted something to him. With eyes that could not focus properly, Corin looked back at the men, then turned and stumbled, tripping over his own feet, into the forest. The forest would protect him, give him a place to hide, to wait, hidden, until the soldiers tired of looking for him and went away. He had not walked far when he heard horses splashing through the shallow water on his side of the river. They had swum across. He could see men climbing back onto their horses, spreading out to search for him. His life was so unfair. Cursed to be a jinx. Exiled from his village, abandoned by his parents, forced out of every village in the land, and now hunted as a bandit. What did it matter if he died now? Without the supplies in his pack, and with an arrowhead in his shoulder, He wouldn't last long in the wilderness anyway.
Good riddance to you, Corin Bladewell, the world said to him. Good riddance to the Jinx. The world is better off without you.
Corin stopped and faced the approaching soldiers, his back to a tree. The arrow shaft brushed against the tree, and Corin's knees buckled with the overwhelming wave of pain. As the soldiers rode up to circle him, he pitched forward onto the ground, and the world slipped away. Lord Pedras Don Salva de la Murta, master wizard and counselor to the throne of Tarador, looked down with dismay at the hem of his purple robe, which was dark and wet from trailing in the river. Certainly, Pedras would have preferred to simply wear pants, much more practical attire for tramping about in the woods. Being a wizard, however, indeed the official court wizard of the land, he had to wear robes, because that is what people expected. Half the power of being a wizard was merely looking like a wizard. If Pedras dressed like a farmer, then he might have to turn a couple people into toads to get some respect. Not that he would, or even could, turn people into toads. The threat was enough. He lifted his robe out of the water, then dropped it, as he realized he looked like what women did with their dresses when stepping over a puddle. Perhaps he could get his robes shortened? He must speak with the royal tailor when he returned to the castle.
Lord Salva, a soldier called out from the riverbank.
Yes,
asked Pedras, without looking up from the river. Pedras had mostly black hair, gone grey at the temples, and he wore his hair long, like most men did, although Pedras did not tie his hair back the way soldiers did. A mustache and a short, pointy black beard added to the wizard's dignity.
What is it?
The soldier held up a worn pack.
I found this in the woods. It could belong to the boy. Doesn't look like the sort of thing bandits would carry.
Very well,
Pedras said, and carefully stepped from one rock to another with long strides back onto the riverbank. The soldier, one of the royal guards, was one of the men who had been in the back of the boat when it was attacked by the bear. The guard, who had been in the front of the boat, was on his way back to the Duke's castle. Pedras had examined the man. He would have an impressive scar on his chest from where the bear's claws had raked him, but otherwise should recover fully.
Tell me again from the beginning.
The soldier related how they had been on a picnic trip for the children. Silly, really, but that is what the princess wanted, and all had been well until the bear charged out of the woods with no warning.
And you say the boy held his hand out, like this, and the bear fell over backwards?
For Pedras, that gesture, arm held straight, palm open, was part of a warding spell. Powerful magic, that was.
Yes, my lord. The bear was on its hind legs. The boy must have startled it, although it did seem as if the bear were flung backwards, almost, instead of falling. Then the bear swatted at its face, as though it were being attacked by bees, and it turned around and ran back into the woods. It seemed to be blind, Lord Wizard.
Curious. Most curious.
Pedras closed his eyes and felt for the lingering power which permeated the area, the water, the rocks, the trees. The power was raw, uncontrolled, and frighteningly strong. The air fairly crackled with connection to the spirit realm. Stronger than any power Pedras had ever felt before, certainly stronger than any magic he had been able to handle himself. And there was something else, separate, something right at the edge of his senses, something sour
and dark and evil. That power he recognized and feared.
Consider this. A bear, a wild animal that should only be looking to survive in the wilderness, for no good reason attacks a boat full of armed guards and charges straight for Ariana. Of all the people in the boat, it concentrates on her. Then this terrible beast that knocked aside three well-armed royal guards... Forgive me, Lord Salva, but it was hardly a fair fight.
Never interrupt a wizard when he is thinking!
Phaedrus roared, using the tiniest bit of magic to add emphasis to his words. The soldier fell to one knee and bowed his head.
Forgive me, my lord.
Forgiven. You accounted very well for yourself. This was no ordinary bear. You faced a dark and foul magic, and faced it bravely. Now, where was I?
Being mildly absent-minded did seem to be typical of wizards.
Ah, yes. So, this terrible magic-spelled beast is then scared away by a boy, a young boy, all by himself. This boy who rescued Ariana from a bear and a raging river and a gang of bandits. Not bad for a morning's work, eh? I shall need to speak with this boy as soon as possible.
I beg to remind you, my lord, the boy was shot. By mistake. And he was almost drowned. Our captain fears he will not survive the day.
Oh, Pedro said, with a smile and a twinkle in his eye. I think the court wizard of Tarador may be able to do something about that.
Chapter 3
How is the boy?
Carlana asked quietly, as she leaned into the doorway. Phaedrus rose from the chair beside Corin's bed. The wizard had sat with the boy through the night.
He will live, Phaedrus said simply. The wound was not deep. The arrow hit his shoulder blade. I healed it as best I could. He did lose a lot of blood. I recommend he drink a broth of beef and vegetables when he awakens. For now, he is in a deep, healing sleep.
Very well.
Carlana didn't need her court wizard to tell her the best remedy to recover from blood loss. She looked out into the hallway and gestured to dismiss her maids.
Who is he?
I don't know. We don't even know his name. From his clothing and the pack we found, I would say he is a peasant, but that doesn't answer what he was doing alone in the woods. The guards searched the woods and found a campsite. The boy had been living there for a week or more.
This boy and a pack of bandits have been using Duke Yaron's private hunting reserve as their campgrounds for more than a week?
Kalana asked with a twinkle in her eye.
I think the Duke's sheriff is going to have much to explain.
Phaedrus did not care about whether people were poaching on the Duke's land.
There is one thing of which we must speak. I don't know who this boy is, or where he came from. But he is a wizard. The most powerful wizard I have ever known.
What? You are sure?
Kalana bit her lip. She saw the look in her wizard's eyes.
Fear.
Phaedrus was afraid. Afraid of this boy.
There can be no mistake about it. He stopped that bear without having any idea how he did it. The fact that the wizard's council knew nothing of this boy, right here in our midst, is deeply troubling.
You didn't know about him?
Carlana frowned. The boy had saved her daughter 3 times in one morning. By rights, she should at least grant the boy a knighthood and 100 acres of land somewhere.
A thought popped into her head. She put one hand over her mouth, the other over her heart, and stepped away from the bed.
Aesidor! If the wizard's council did not know about him, could he—
No, no. Phaedrus dismissed the idea with a wave of his hand. There is no trace of the foul magics our enemy uses to confound us. He has not come from Aesidor. I'm certain of it. When the boy wakes, I will talk to him, learn where he came from, and what he knows of magic. Until then, we let him rest.
Corin awoke to the sound of voices, women's voices. He lay very still and cracked open one eye just wide enough to see where he was. In a bed, a big, soft bed, with his head resting on a real pillow. Beyond the bed, the room appeared to be large, and through an open window he could see flags flying in the breeze, and soldiers standing on top of a thick stone wall. He must be in a castle, somewhere.
Corin had never seen a real castle. The only one around Krebs Ford was the small building that was home to the Baron of Crichton County. What was he doing in...
Soldiers. He remembered being captured by soldiers.
Can't believe everything the High and Mighty tell you, Matilda. Why, I heard the little scamp was living in the Duke's own private hunting reserve, he was, poaching deer and scooping up all the fish. Don't know as how the sheriff didn't find him first. He's supposed to be patrolling those woods. And you know, Duke Yaron don't take kindly to poachers. No, he doesn't.
I heard that poaching be the least of his worries, said another woman's voice.
Found him with a pack of bandits, the guards did. And he led them on a merry chase before they captured him. Likely he was trying to kidnap poor Ariana. So you can talk all you want about him being a scamp. I say he's a menace, pure and simple. Wouldn't turn my back on him, I wouldn't, no matter how young he is.
Corin could hear the two women. He was laying on his side with his back to them.
Well, the wizard will have the truth out of him, sure enough. In here all night with the boy, conjuring up demons or what not it is wizards do. Gives me the creeps, it does. And the sooner that wizard is out of here and back to the palace, the happier I'll be. It gives me the creeps just to be in here, where he was working his foul magic. Finish folding those sheets, Matilda, and let's be rid of here. Fancy letting this boy sleep in here. Should be in the dungeon, he should. They'll hang him soon enough.
There were rustling sounds, and shoes scuffing across the floor, and a door opening and closing with a solid thunking sound. Corin remained still for a good minute, until he was certain the women had gone, before he opened both eyes.
His head was spinning. Duke Yaron?
He didn't know that name, so he must not be in his home Winterthur province. Whoever this Duke Yaron was, he apparently considered Corin to be a poacher, and a bandit, and a kidnapper.
Corin raised his head from the pillow and looked around the room. It was the most fabulous place he had ever imagined. The ceiling had to be 12 feet high, and the room was bigger than the entire common room at the Golden Trout Inn in Krebs Ford. Bigger even than many barns in his hometown. There were pictures in gold-plated frames, large wall hangings, and an enormous fireplace at the far end of the room, over which was a crest, a red fox on a field of white. A large, fancy, carved desk was up against the outside wall. Corin could see scuff marks on the stone floor where the desk had been pushed to make room for the bed he lay in. Why was he in such a place? Were the Duke's dungeons full? Surely the Duke didn't treat all poachers, bandits, and kidnappers by giving them a soft bed to lay in. A chill ran up Corin's spine. The women said something about a wizard working foul magic on him.
Corin abruptly sat upright in bed, his stomach churning with fear. What had the wizard done to him? Corin had never met a wizard. All he knew about wizards were the fearful stories told around Krebs Ford. He pulled up the covers. He still had his own